So, but I thought I'd tell you about this, some work on black holes that Oliver Winkler and I have been working on for about a year and a half or so. And this whole thing was motivated by trying to understand whether or not there's Hawking radiation, and if there is, how it arises, and what's the end point of Hawking evaporation. So what we did is we started off from scratch and started to think about the following model. So we have dr plus the scale of field. And the scale of field is minimally coupled. So, and the equations that we looked at from a Hamiltonian point of view are just Einstein's equations. So we have GAB, 8 pi KAB, where the metric spherical symmetry is a function of R and T, scale of field, of course, also a function of R and T, and stress energy tensor is that of the minimally coupled scalar field, which you all know, so TAB.
R is the radial coordinate?
Mm-hmm.
R is the radial coordinate?
Yeah, I'm just going to be more specific than that. Yeah. That's great. Now, this is a very old problem, and people started thinking about this right after Hawking's calculation. In fact, the first person to start thinking about this was Unruh. And just to, before I say what he tried to do, just be specific about the metric. So we're looking at the metric concepts I1b that he did, which is rt squared plus dr squared, d squared of rt plus r squared d under squared. So this, of course, is the most general spherical symmetric metric. It's got two functions in it. And so what he did was he followed up on some, actually followed up and corrected some work initially by Berger, Chitrit, Monteith, and Lipkow. So Unruh was, I think, 1976. And this is something like 1973. So what these guys did is the ADM formulation was starting to be applied after the work of Wheeler and DeWitt. And so they decided to apply it to this system and to fix all the gauges and reduce the problem. Now, you know that if you're in spherical symmetry and there's no matter, the only solution is Schwarzschild. That's Birkhoff's theorem. And if M is zero, it's flat space. So when you couple a scalar field, it's a field theory with it's a two-dimensional field theory with 1 degree of freedom. So the system is really a 1 plus 1 field theory. And so it didn't feel like much of a problem to try to write down this one-dimensional field theory explicitly. So if you fix all the gauges, you could get the metric functions to drop out, and the only degree of freedom would come from the scalar field. Or some other combination, the scalar field and F and G, but there's only 1 degree of freedom which has dynamics. So what these people did is they thought, okay, we'll work out the Hamiltonian formulation using ADM, and then just quantize it. If we quantize it, there will be some semi-classical regime in which, they didn't do all this, but that was their idea. There will be some semi-classical regime where gravity is classical and the matter is quantum, and maybe we'll see Hawking radiation coming out. So they tried to work out a Hamiltonian formulation. They made a little mistake, because if in the asymptotically flat regime, the Hamiltonian formulation needs a surface term. They forgot about the surface term. And so the reduced Hamiltonian they got for just the scalar field was not correct. So Unruh came along. This is this famous paper, Notes on Black Hole Evaporation. One part of that paper sort of corrected this work and derived the Hamiltonian for the scalar field in fixed gauge. So he fixed a radial coordinate gauge and a time coordinate gauge. So that's going to be our starting point. And then we'll take a sidestep from here. So essentially what he did is he said fix time gauge. It doesn't matter what it is now, some time gauge. Fix radial gauge. And when you do that, you worked out a Hamiltonian for the scalar field. Now, just to tell you why this problem didn't get anywhere, I will write down that Hamiltonian. Okay, I'll just write down this form since I forgot it. So you found that if you start with this theory, you go to ADM's Hamiltonian formula, you have to solve the gauges, so you get a Hamiltonian which looks something like this. Some function phi has conjugate momentum p phi e to the integral some other function phi and p phi dr. Okay, that was a reduced Hamiltonian.
Is that zero to r or infinity to r?
That's infinity to r. It's zero to r. It doesn't really matter if it's zero or infinity. The point is that this is a non-local guy. And so this is a non-local. And so he left it there. He said this is the correct Hamiltonian for the simple problem. If you fix all, fix the time gauge and the radial gauge. And he left it with a little sentence. And the sentence was, I present it here in the hope that someone else may be able to do something with it. And that's where the problem stood. So what we decided to do is we wanted to get to the bottom of this and figure out why this crazy Hamiltonian was coming out. What we found is that it's due to fixing a radial gauge. So I'll tell you why that is and how we avoid that problem and try to come back and try to solve this problem in full quantum theory. So we haven't finished that, but I'll start you from scratch and lead you to where we are right now, okay, in the next 3 hours. So along the way, the first thing I'll point out is why the Hamiltonian formulation leads to this problematical Hamiltonian, this radial gauge, and how we can avoid it, and then go on. So here's sort of the rough outline. I'll read you the classical theory. So this is the classical EDM formalism for this problem. EDM is Arnold Desmond. This time we've done that Hamiltonian formulation again, haven't you? Yes.
So in two dimensions, the scalar field is then conformed in
right? No, this is not a conformal field theory.
So it's not conformal invariant.
No.
But one can always add a term proportional to the R as to make it conformal invariant.
Proportional to R meaning which is scalar?
Yeah, in four dimensions it's -1/6 R.
Ah, you mean to make it conformally coupled?
Yeah, conformally coupled.
Ah, yes, yes. So we are in four dimensions. We could do a conformally coupled scalar field, but we're doing a minimal coupled scalar field.
So my question is that since the metric is sort of, I mean, if the only interest in part is in R and T, that part, couldn't that always be killed by conformal transformation?
Not if we're in minimally coupled. So we're four dimensional DR, we're reducing, and if we start off with a scalar field that's minimally coupled,
yeah,
we can't do that.
No.
No. Yeah, we can only do that if we start with conformal coupling.
So that was my reason for asking. If you do conformal coupling, maybe one can simplify it.
Ah, okay. We have looked at this. Maybe that's possible.
Because I think the first two terms can just be cancelled. You just get the Euclidean first two terms.
The first two terms can be cancelled, meaning what?
Yeah, for both F and R, because that two-dimensional part is always conformally flat.
Oh, you mean there's only one function here? In the metric that eventually arises without gauges. I haven't done that exercise, so I can't show you.
So it's any two-dimensional metric is conformally flat.
Yeah, but this is not a two-dimensional metric. It's 4D GR.
It's 4D
GR and spherical symmetry.
Yeah.
So if you start with a different problem, which is I'm doing 4D GR minimally conformally coupled to a scalar field, then to the spherical symmetric reduction, then I don't know what the story is.
Yeah.
I suspect that because of the Hamiltonian constraint and a Diffeo constraint, I don't think we can avoid this particular problem if it's a real gate. So when I say 1 plus 1 field theory, I really mean that although we're in four dimensions, in spherical symmetry, everything is a function of RMT, and therefore the three is a two-dimensional field theory. It's not any simple two-dimensional field theory that I've ever seen. If it was conformally invariant, then of course there's a whole bunch of tools available. Maybe you're just looking at it with the wrong set of coordinates. But it's not. Okay. So first I'll do the classical ADM formalism and do it slightly differently. This is going to be adapted to flat slice coordinates, rather than Minkowski, rather than Schwarzschild coordinates. So I'll tell you what that is. Then we'll build up to, I'll point out some classical results, which are numerical. Won't take long, escape them. Collapse. And then we'll start quantizing this. And the quantization will borrow ideas from loop quantum gravity. So it's not loop quantum gravity per se, it will be some loop LQG ideas. And when I write it down, you'll see where the LQG ideas come from. And then we'll set up the quantum collapse problem. And what I mean by setting up the quantum collapse problem, it's going to look very much, or as much like the classical results on the classical collapse problem set up that people have studied numerically. So we want to set the same thing up, basically follow a chunk of quantum matter field as it evolves using the quantum Einstein equation and see what happens to it. Okay, that's sort of the idea. Okay, so that's roughly what I'm going to talk about. Okay, so first let me tell you what I mean by adapted to flat slice coordinates before working out this classical ADM formula. You've all seen Schwarzschild in the usual form. You can also write the Schwarzschild metric in the following form. Schwarzschild metric, and this form was discovered a long time ago by Pandavi and Gulstan. In an attempt to prove that something is wrong with Einstein's theory. So the reason it's called flat slice coordinates for Schwarzschild is if you look at a constant t slice. So t equals constant slice, let's put t equals constant, and you get flat free space. Okay, so that's why it's called flat slice for it. So t equals constant slices are flat. It's very important generalization of Schwarzschild, it's regular at the horizon, and it was, I guess, first used by Wilczek and Krauss trying to find corrections to Hawking radiation. Okay. So how do we adapt the Hamiltonian formalism, or how do we get a Hamiltonian formalism for adapted to these coordinates, or for that matter, for Schwarzschild coordinates? Well, there are a number of pieces. So first piece, well, since we know the ADM formalism, we want to start with QAD and PiAD. And they showed, of course, that S of GR is nothing but PiAD really be dot minus n times the Hamiltonian constraint minus na times the Diffeo constraint dx dt plus some surface term, which is n to some dm, and some surface term that goes here to make the Hamiltonian formulation well defined. In other words, you want to vary this action with respect to q, with respect to pi, with respect to n and na. You want to be able to write the Hamiltonian form of the action for something times delta q and something times delta pi. Otherwise, the variational principle is not well defined. So you need surface term. You don't need to do that. So as it turns out, if you want to start with this and apply it to spherically symmetric collapse, what do you do? Well, one way to proceed is the following. And this applies also to the Ashikar-Hamiltonian formalism. One way to do it, of course, is to say, right, I'm going to start with Einstein's equations, plug in the symmetry reduction ansatz, and work out the Hamiltonian formalism for the reduced form of the action. Another way to do it is, since we know what the Hamiltonian formalism is, we just plug in the parameterization for QAB and PiAB. Or QAB and PiAB such that grad S goes over to integral dr dt times some variable, I don't know, r, pr, r dot pr plus, I don't know, y dot p phi, cannot elaborate on this figure, plus whatever. In other words, plug in a parameterization such that the action takes a manifestly canonical form for some variables that parameterize the metric and the extrinsic curvature. So what parameterization do we use, and how do we tell the difference between a Schwarzschild parameterization and, for example, Pavlov-Boltzmann parameterization? Well, first let's turn back to Schwarzschild. The important thing is follow-up conditions. Conditions on the phase space variables. Okay, if we're in Schwarzschild coordinates, we know that asymptotically the metric is flat. In Pein-Levy-Boltzmann coordinates, the metric is flat, spatial metric is flat, period, not just asymptotically flat. So if we're doing Schwarzschild coordinateization, then we have QAB is something flat plus some function of beta phi over r squared, sorry, over r, plus terms of order 1 over r squared.
What about the factor of 2 in the dr squared?
What about the factor of 2?
So if you have a constant time slices,
yeah,
two contributions to the metric by dr squared.
The second dr squared is redundant, right?
It looks that way.
Oh, did I write that right? It doesn't matter, you just rescale R by half. Let me just tell you the correct form. You can just rescale it, that's not a problem at all. You should have stopped me earlier if you're worried about that.
No.
Oh, sorry, there's no extra DR. You're right. You carried away there, writing an extra DR. Okay. The important things are the follow-up conditions on Q and pi. Yeah, if I make a mistake like that, catch me right away instead of waiting two more blackboards. Should I write down here? And for Schwarzschild coordinates, you have to specify follow-up conditions on Qs and Pis. So for Pi AB, it's quite easy. It's EF of G can be some angular coordinates or r squared plus order of r cubed. Okay. Now, this is the standard prescription for asymptotic flatness in Schwarzschild coordinates. it is not the standard prescription for asymptotic flatness if you use Pan-Levy-Goldstein coordinates. So in Pan-Levy-Goldstein coordinates, let's see here, the coordinatization is, of course, QAB is EAB, period.
So
I'm
not
sure.
Yes. So
this
EAB, was that
is a flat
metric?
No? EAB is a flat metric. Yes.
And what's the
argument?
0 and 5 or
FAB
or?
Yeah. Sorry, you said
theta 5.
Okay. Yes, angular coordinates. Okay. Yeah. So in general, okay. So EAB is flat three metric. Now, if we're exactly in Schwarzschild, QAB is EAB, but there's probably some correction, which is going to be higher order if there's some matter, if we're not in fixed gauge. Otherwise, it's exactly this. So I'll just leave it like this for now, and add a correction term later. And pi AB, this is if you're exactly Schwarzschild, PG, exactly rather flat slice, exactly PG, and let's say pi equals 0. In other words, there's no matter. Pi AB, it turns out, is some constant over R to the 3 halves. This is what you get for Schwarzschild. Of course, if you're Schwarzschild here, then this is 1, this is not there, this is not there, and this is some constant. Okay. The mass information in the case of Schwarzschild is contained in the metric, as you all know. Right? The mass information in PG coordinates cannot be contained in QAB because QAB is flat. So it has to be contained in the extensive curvature. So you can, as a little exercise, take that metric and just work out its extensive curvature, and you'll see that it's proportional to 1 over r to the 3 halves. Now, the momentum conjugate to Q is not the extrinsic curvature, it's some function of the linear function of the extrinsic curvature, but it's still proportional to 1 over r to the 3 halves. Okay, so the bottom line is when we pick a parameterization for Q and pi, we have to be careful that it has the right follow-up conditions, and if you have matter coupling, we have to have follow-up conditions on the matter fields as well and the matter momentum. Okay. And then you plug it in, you derive the surface term by requiring that the action be functionally differentiable. And I'm not going to go through all the whole exercise, I'll just give you the parameterization. If you want the details, look it up in one of the papers, which I'll put a reference to. So what is the parameterization that we use? I'm sort of rushing through the classical part because I want to get to the quantum part and spend more time, but if you want to slow down, just say so. Okay, so parameterization. Phase-space variables. So we take the following form with QAB. We'll use the same notation because we're going to get confused later on. Yeah. Lambda squared n a n b plus r squared. These are all functions of r and t over r squared. Ab minus n a n b, where n a x a over r, the r is x a c d a b. So in other words, this is the radial direction and this is the angular direction. If I write this out in sort of ds squared form, three metric fields, it's lambda squared of rt, dr squared plus r squared, union a squared. Okay. Now the reason there's a little r squared here if I take a, b, and subtract off the radial direction, I get r squared t omega squared. So I have to divide by little r squared. Okay, so this is the easy part. Right now, there's nothing that says that this will give you a Schwarzschild or something else, because I haven't specified boundary conditions. Now I have to give you the parameterization for pi ab cooked up such that it has momentum conjugate for this function, momentum conjugate for this function, and such that pi ab qab dot takes the canonical form. Okay, so that's not hard to do. So play around a little bit, and what you find is that pi ab densitizes, takes the form p lambda over 2 lambda in d plus r squared pr sub r over 4 times r pab minus na in d. So now if you just compute pi ab qab dot, and when you compute qab dot, you get 2 lambda lambda dot. The 2 lambda cancels this, so we get lambda dot p lambda. That's one term. If you compute qab dot on this, you get 2 times big r dot. There's a 4r, the r cancels. There's a pr, the r squared cancels. And you get exactly this thing reducing to pr r dot. And then, of course, there's 5. 5 is an appearing metric. So that's just on the side. So finally, when you plug that ends up in this action, S, then here is just integral dr dt, don't mind the constants up there, dr dot, plus lambda, lambda dot, d phi, phi dot, plus n, times the Hamiltonian constraint, times na, and r, times the radial part of the diffeo constraint, the other two vanish. And then there's some surface term, which I still won't write down.
Okay.
Is
the
5 the scalar field? 5 is the scalar field, yeah. So just to tell you what the forms of these are, I'm just going to write down H and CR. So H and CR, you know, in terms of the full pi and Q, H is 1 over root Q, pi AB, and it's 1/2. Pi squared, these are all the densitized guys, minus root q times the Ricci scalar plus 2 pi squared over 2 root q plus root q dab dfi and d phi half. So that's the Hamiltonian constraint in the full form for scalar field coupling. What you do to work out the simplified form of this is take that QAB, take that PiAB, plug it in here, and you get the simplified form for H. Okay? And it's something. And the same with the Diffeo constraint. So you've got CR is whatever it is. Actually, I'll just write it down. So CA. The full CA is DA DB phi DB. So all we need to do is work out just the C, the radial part that comes from using that answer. Yes?
So, sorry, maybe I'm mistaken, but isn't pi squared?
No, oh, sorry, I should tell you what pi is. Yeah, sorry, that's just a trace of pi. So it's a different object. Anything else?
The densifies in the constant C A B. an old there.
Yes. Yeah, it's all density spaces. It's for all density. So the bottom line is when you work out the reduced constraints, I'll just write them down so you know what they look like.
We have to deal with them in the quantum theory.
Now, so when you simplify it all down, we get sort of still messy looking, but at least
see what you're dealing with.
Get H.
It's 1/r². I'll write the whole thing out
because we're going to do partial gauge fixing, not the full gauge fixing. And I'll show you why unruh about the non-local Hamiltonian as we go through this.
So this is just straightforward arithmetic
when you plug that into those things. The Hamiltonian constraint. You see, it's got all the right sort of pieces. This piece just comes from here, pi and b pi and b minus pi squared. This piece comes from the Ricci scalar part. This would vanish if we were in the gauge big R equals little r. So if big R equals little r, this is 0, this is 1, so if we have minus 2r. We need both the gauge lambda equals 1 to get flat slice and big R equals little r. In that gauge, this just vanishes. Okay. And this is just these two pieces in this gauge. And finally, the Diffeo constraint, CR, is the following. It's CR r prime. Minus lambda, p lambda prime, plus p phi, phi prime. All the primes, of course, are just r derivatives. Yeah. It's just an r and the p, of course. Okay, and now I'll just give you a reference to a whole bunch of other stuff, details of fallout conditions and so on. So the reference, if you want to see details of all this, is VRQC 050303031. So what you find here is the fall-off conditions on each of the phase space variables that comes from conditions like this. Okay. So the criteria for all the fall-off conditions is that not just that the variation principle be well-defined, but that the action is well-defined. So the action being well-defined means that S equals 0 to infinity or something is bounded. Okay, this is a separate condition from the condition of functional differentiability. So some of the fall-off conditions come from this. And this, of course, applies. This means that every term in here has to be bounded. And so we have to worry about fall-off conditions on each of the pieces. So they're all in that reference. OK, so now coming to the gauge fixing, full gauge fixing versus partial gauge fixing before going to the quantum theory. And this is sort of important because it gives you a problem you can go somewhere with or not go anywhere with. That's the end of the case. Now, how do you gauge your thing and implement it consistently? You have to follow a bunch of steps for doing canonical gauge fixing. So I'll indicate it schematically rather than details for this particular case. So the general scheme is you start off with a Hamiltonian theory with some first class constraints. And I didn't say that these are first class here, and they remain first class here. So if you compute the Poisson bracket of H with H, it closes on CR. CR does what it's supposed to. It generates Lie dragging of phase space variables and so on. So in canonical gauge fixing, what we need to do is this is sort of schematic. Let's say we're in the case where we've got just two coordinates to fix. So we say T is some function of the P's and Q's. By P's and Q's, I mean pi's and QABs. And you say R is some other function of P's and Q's. Okay. Now, how do we know this is a good gauge fixing and whether it actually does implement gauge fixing? Well, there's a bunch of checks. The first check is, let's focus on that one. If you do a canonical gauge fixing, you want the gauge fixing to be preserved in time. What does that mean? This means that I have to make sure that T dot, if I want to use T as time and T dot as just one, but T dot is also equal to F TQ evolve. How do you evolve? Well, for some bracket of integral of N H plus N A C A. All that has to be equal one for this gauge fixing to be preserved in time. Okay. It just says the evolution of this phase space variable F dot is the same as T dot and it has to be one. So what this gives you, it gives you condition on N as a function of N A. Okay. Or the other way around. Then, of course, we also want the same thing for R. So we have R dot 1 is equal to G TQ. Same thing. And this gives you some other function, N as a function of N. Okay.
So in general, they need not exist such functions, right? At least just because you're in two dimensions, right? You're symmetrically better.
Well, you can use even in higher dimensions, without reduction in four dimensions. People have looked at specific time gauges like fixed volume, the Bjorg gauge for time, and so on, and tried to work out the corresponding evolution equations in those gauges.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter. It's not specific to the reduction. Here I'm just using the reduction. So here this gives you another function. And then together it's all these. There are different conditions because when I take the Poisson bracket of G with the Hamiltonian, I get something different than if I take the Poisson bracket of F with the Hamiltonian. So I have to self-consistently see the solution here. So I get N explicitly and NA explicitly. Easy way to see all this is, of course, go to cosmology and do the Hamiltonian formulation of FRW cosmology properly. And you see that, for example, N equals 1 gauge, which everybody puts in by hand, actually arises from a precise canonical condition on time. Okay. There's no mix-up because, you know, there is no NA. It's homogeneous and isotropic. So we're just dealing with this part. And so the condition N equals 1 is actually a derived condition in the canonical theory. And it's derived in precisely this way. Fix a good T, work out the corresponding N, and now you have your gauge fixed equations. All right? So this is the schematic. That's what we did over here. And that's what Andrew did, of course. So
is R dot, I see that as a velocity, so why is R
dot equal? Oh, sorry, R prime.
Very good.
Yeah. Hold on. I'm sorry, it is R dot, but it's zero. So that's the recommendation.
Very good. Yeah, I will just copy this down and into that. R dot, R doesn't depend on time, it's zero, gives this condition. This is time, it's one, this is condition. Okay, so that's the schematic, and so we have to do that here. Now, all I want to point out here in the rest of this is why it is that Andrew got this messy Hamiltonian that he got. Now, when you fix the gauge, you still have to worry about the fact that you've got constraints. They didn't just go away because you fixed a gauge. So what you have to do is you have to solve the Hamiltonian strongly. If you fix the time gauge, the Hamiltonian constraint has to be solved strongly. If you fix the radial gauge, the Diffeo constraint has to be solved strongly. So strongly solving a Diffeo constraint means setting this equal to zero strongly if, let's say, you pick big R equals to R. Let's do that. So let's choose. That's a nice gauge condition. And we can worry about finding what the corresponding NR is, but this will tell you what NR is. It's something, and it'll tell you what it is by doing this. But now let's, we have to solve CR strongly. Now, this eliminates capital R as a phase space variable. It's gone. Which means that we have to solve CR for its corresponding momentum. Phase space variable R is gone. Its momentum is not a dynamical thing in theory anymore. If there's no R, PRR doesn't make sense. You have to solve the constraint for PR. For PR. Because it is the canonical momentum of big R. Well, if I solve this thing strongly for PR, let's plug in the gauge, what happens? Well, the big R is little r, this is just 1. And so it looks like what I get is PR equal to times P by phi prime minus lambda. Okay, so this is part of what you get if you fix this gauge. Now, what about the time gauge? Now, the time gauge Andrew used involved actually the momentum, not a coordinate. So he had t equals some function of momentum, forget which momentum it was. It's a function of a, one of the momenta. And it turned out that when he solved for the coordinate corresponding to this, he got an integral of the kind that appeared inside that integral. Okay. That's really the bottom line. I mean, I don't want to go through the details of this, of that. You can find it in this paper. And so when he fixed t is a function of one of the specific momenta combined with this, he got this messy Hamiltonian that I put up there. It turns out that it doesn't matter what slicing you use. We can use the slicing, we can use the flat slicing. If we fix both gauges, we have the same problem too. So it doesn't matter what the asymptotic conditions are. If you pick this condition, in addition to some other time gauge condition, it doesn't have to be a momentum, it could also be a coordinate. You still have this problem for non-local Hamiltonian. So how do you proceed? Well, the only way we thought of proceeding is let us not do this. Let's just fix the time gauge, but let's not fix the radial coordinate gauge. Okay. Then see what the Hamiltonian is and see if we can actually do something with it. So that was the strategy. And so the bottom line here is simply what I just said. That the gauge condition PR, sorry, PR R together with
time gauge is an envelope. It just sounds on there. So, essentially, in everything that we did, the lesson learned was do not fix the article R. In other words, let R remain a dynamical variable. Of course, we know that if we only fix one gauge, we're only going to deal with one constraint. So we will still have a constraint system. That's okay. You can still work with a constraint system that's smaller than the original constraint system and yet get something manageable as opposed to what we got. Okay? So that was the strategy. Any questions so far?
So can you do the quantum theory? You don't enforce that constraint. That's
the one that's left over.
Yes.
So now I'm going to tell you what we did do. We fixed the time gauge, and the time gauge we fixed, we wanted to fix the time gauge because the bottom line is that we wanted to, if you do full Dirac quantization with no gauge fixing, the problem is one of interpretation, whether you're applying it to a particular system like a collapse problem or you're doing it in general, how do you interpret what you get? How do you see evolution? And at least probably talked about this in Carlos' book too. You can try all kinds of tricks for simple systems and get something, but if you have a full field theory like we have here, then it's not so easy. Okay. So if you pick the time gauge, you always know you're talking about some time. You know what evolution means with respect to that time. We want to get to the bottom of fucking radiation, so we're just going to work on a fixed time gauge. You can always worry about big R later. Okay. So essentially, we fix only a time gauge. And I'll just tell you a couple of steps. Remember the form of the metric in our parametrization? There it is. It was lambda squared to dr squared plus r squared d omega squared. That's the parametrization for the free metric. So the time gauge we fix, because we have flat slicing in mind, if the gauge lambda equals 1. Okay. This means that we have to solve h equals 0 for phi lambda. Then both lambda and phi lambda are gone from the problem, and we get a partially gauged fixed action to work with. So if we solve for phi lambda, then wherever we see a phi lambda, we're going to have to plug in for that expression. So where's the Hamiltonian constraint? It was up there. Anyway, what you get is a quadratic equation for phi lambda. Take the Hamiltonian constraint with lambda equals 1 everywhere, you get quadratic equation for phi lambda. Okay. So now what's happened to our action? Well, a couple of things have happened to the action. Remember we started off with S equals VRDT. Lambda dot p lambda plus phi dot p phi plus r dot p r minus n h minus n r c r plus n d t surface term, which I never wrote down. Now we fix the gauge lambda equals 1, so S gauge fixed is equal to integral d r d t. Now we know what t is. T is the one given by that gauge fixing condition. Lambda is 1, so lambda dot is 0, so this term drops out. Then we have phi dot p phi plus r dot p r as our only remaining phase space variables. Yeah,
so I have a question. So you get a quadratic equation for p lambda.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the two solutions
then. Ah, good, yes.
And then it doesn't completely fix the gauge, right?
Oh, no. So what happens is we get two solutions.
Yeah.
Now we have to ask, suppose we were just doing Schwarzschild. If we were just doing Schwarzschild, what sign is picked by Schwarzschild? We pick that sign. And that's the relevant gauge fixing for.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So here, of course, I skipped over that. You get two solutions, and one is the physical in the sense that matter is zero, it gives the structure flat slice.
So how do you do that? Is that also a gauge?
No, this is not a gauge fixing at all. It's simply the fact. It's
consistent.
Yeah, it's just that. Yes, yeah. That's right. So one is physical, and physical, i.e., structure for matter equals zero, for phi equals zero. Phi equals p bar equals zero. So we pick the same sign because all we're doing is when we want the matter off, we want to get Schwarzschild back. We don't want to get something crazy.
Okay. Crazy.
Which is negative mass Schwarzschild.
With the unphysical solution corresponding to
negative mass Schwarzschild.
Negative.
Okay, so that's what I mean by physical. So, okay, so anything else here? So we're back here now. H is solved strongly, H is gone because P lambda is gone. Now you have minus NRCR. And CR is now reduced because remember CR had a lambda, P lambda in it. So I'll just write that down. If there are any lambdas here, they get set equal to 1. If there are any P lambdas here, they get set equal to the solution, the quadratic solution we found for P lambda. So this is the gauge fixed action. It's two canonical variables, a single constraint, and I'll write down that constraint again for you. So before gauge fixing, we had CR was equal to PR, R prime plus P phi, phi prime minus lambda, lambda prime. And that was between 0 and 4. Now lambda is 1, and p lambda is some solution of all the other canonical variables. So after gauge fixing, I'll write CR gauge fixed, which is what goes here, is just equal to PR, r prime plus p phi, phi prime minus p lambda prime, which is now a function of r, pr, phi, p phi. Okay. And so this is the theory we're going to quantize. Notice that it's still got an nr in it, and that nr is actually free completely because we still have a first class constraint left. Okay, so I'm going to start with the classical theory, but just write down what I just said. Only now to quantize.
Just you have said in that something. What role does the end of year corner?
Ah, okay, just the surface term and the follow-up condition.
So Penlevé's is for Schwarzschild specifically?
No, Penlevé can be used for any spherically symmetric metric.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, but then it doesn't have a specific form.
Let me write down. So I wrote down the general form of the Schwarzschild metric. Well, not the Schwarzschild, but the general spherically symmetric metric in the diagonal coordinates.
Yeah.
So in the Penlevé case, the general metric has got those two functions in it. Okay. Two functions f and g, such that, again, if you put t equals constant, the slice is flat. So every spherically symmetric metric admits a foliation by flat slices. Okay. So really, when we put in the boundary conditions corresponding to asymptotic flatness, we are really dealing with a metric of this type at the covariant level. All right. So our goal now is to quantize this particular action. next. Sometimes S gauge takes, so we have fixed variables 5T5, RTR, and we have a single first class constraint, CR. Zero CR is that form.
Okay. Yeah, probably.
Yeah, of course.
So already writing that DS in that form is a gauge fixing in RFT.
Well, it's a choice of parameterization rather than a gauge fixing. Choice of parameterization means that I could, for example, if I when I wrote down the Schwarzschild form, which is minus F squared RT, dr squared dt squared plus d squared RT, dr squared plus r squared is omega squared. This is a choice of parameterization because if we work out the canonical period, there are still first class constraints there. Mm-hmm. And the gauges are not fixed. It's still a theory with first class constraints.
The gauge here is coarse transformation, so there is some fixing of the gauge. But
only partial fixing. So every so that fixing only involves going to a coordinate system that is adapted to spherical symmetry. That's the only gauge fixing I'm doing. So if I go from GAB full form with full blown 10 functions and write it in spherical symmetry, then I choose the usual spherical coordinates. And you can write the most general metric in spherical symmetry in this form. But, so the kind of fixing that's gone in is to say that we have chosen coordinates that corresponds to BD phi, the three angular momentum generators, and the definition of the R coordinate. That's all that's gone in. If I work out now the canonical theory, I still have first class constraints, I still have gauge freedom. Which means there's still a redundancy, a gauge redundancy in these two functions or these two functions.
So is this a proper characterization? I don't know if it is, but this is my what I just talked about.
Okay.
So if this is RMT,
yeah.
Then what was left is a gauge along T and then a gauge along R. So you cannot do general diffeomorphisms. This is very
That's right, you can't do general diffeomorphism because there's only a single gauge generator left.
So that's right. You can use general diffeomorphisms.
But this is not general because it's already in spherical symmetry. It's just
RMT. But with respect to RMT.
Yes, you can. Yeah. I mean, here you could too. I can still do general coordinate transformations. Any one, of course, here. But once I fix the parameterization I'm using in spherical symmetry, I'm still carrying along some gauge degrees of freedom. No problem.
So the Fender-Weil form out there.
Yeah.
If you do a general diffeomorphism of that line, then it won't stay in that form anymore. Right? Why? No.
Well, R squared do omega still. It depends on what I do. So if I make
only RNT.
Yeah, so only RNT remains. RNT remains here, unless I want to mix in angles and wreck this thing too. This part is still separate from both and untouched.
Yeah.
So it's only the RNT part I can do things with. Another way to think about this is suppose I ask for the vacuum solution, then I know that clearly there's a lot of gauge here because there's only one. Functions are one parameter worth of solutions, n. If I couple a scalar field, then I know that I have a scalar field degree of freedom, and now in spherical symmetry, I should have a truly local degree of freedom in the scalar field. Because if I didn't have it and I fixed gauges, these two would be gone. So when I have a scalar field and I fix all gauges, these two would be gone, but I still have the scalar field left. And some messy form of the metric where this function and this function would involve the scalar field. Because that's the only degree of freedom remaining after all the gauges. So I think it's important to distinguish between a parameterization parametric and a fully gauge fixed metric. And the easiest way I can tell the difference is if I take a form of a metric and go to the ABM theory, I ask, are the constraints automatically zero, or are they not automatically zero? If all the constraints are automatically zero, then I fixed everything. For example, when I do FRW and go to homogeneity and isotropy, none of my metric functions depends on the spatial coordinate. So therefore, no diffeo constraints are left, no spatial diffeo constraints are left over, only the Hamiltonian constraint is left over, so I still have time reparameterization freedom. And I do, if I write down the flux, FRW. Okay, I can go to conformal time, I can go to minus dt squared plus a squared flat, which is not conformal time. So I can choose a whole bunch of conformal times. That's the freedom. Similarly, there's a T and R, both freedom here. Okay, so coming to the quantum theory then, and this is the part of the name, some contact with OPG. Actually, I was going to say something about classical results, so maybe we'll spend 10 minutes saying that because it's important for how we set up the quantum problem. After this, I'll take a little break, get a drink of water, and then. So classical results. The first, and it doesn't matter what coordinates we have, there's sort of, in my view, three main types of classical results on this model. The first set is due to Christodoulou. I think it's about 1975. A whole bunch of analysis on exactly the spherically symmetric, minimally scalar field, minimally coupled to gravity equations with asymptotic flatness. Okay, all those conditions. So I'll just write it again here. We have spherical symmetry, asymptotically flat. Phi minimally coupled. What Christodoulou showed is that there are two types of initial data for this problem. So call it leak data. And strong data. If you take weak data, essentially, all the data is really contained in the initial profile of the scalar field and its commutative momentum, because the constraints tell you what the other functions are. So the only three functions you specify is phi and p phi. Weak data is no black hole formation. So the picture is you take some phi and p phi, and you let it go, and you ask, what is the long time evolution? So in these cases, the long-time evolution of the scalar field does all kinds of stuff, but a black hole doesn't form. Strong data, black hole forms. And these are sort of strong, hard analysis results, 100 pages in CMP, okay. three papers, I think. So what he couldn't get at analytically was what happens, what is the transition region in the initial data between weak and strong. And he proposed that as a numerical problem. Okay. So this left a question, and he actually posed the question, what is the transition? Okay. In other words, what is the transition means, what sort of data is exactly at the transition point between weak and strong? And when black holes do form, how do they form? Do they form with zero mass? Do they form with a mass gap? How do they form? Okay.
The weak and strong data is the initial conditions of the
scalar. That's right. Yeah, that's right. So you're specifying phi and p phi. That's the initial data. You don't need to specify the metric functions because, as I said, if phi and p phi are zero, you get Bartholdy-Kopp's theorem only partial. So it's only when phi and p phi are non-zero that there's real data, in a sense. Yeah.
So what it's showing is that the phase space divides up into two regions.
Exactly.
One region, there's no black hole. And
right.
The other region is an attractor.
That's right, exactly. So what is the transition? And people who talked about this was Andrew and Matt Choptwick. and probably heard of Matt Chopik's results. Andrew posed this as a problem to him for his PhD. He didn't solve it in his PhD, but he solved it 3 years later. So what he showed was that, and I'm going to say a little bit about how this was done because it's relevant for setting up the quantum collapse problem. But what he found is if you take the following thing, r equals 0 as a function of r, that's the initial data. If you take some sort of nice profile like this, with some parameters, say height, width, maybe some other parameter, it doesn't matter, it doesn't have to be a Gaussian, just some nice smooth data with no singularities of any kind, differentiable and so on. It doesn't even have to be differentiable really. He took data which wasn't, he just took a step. And then he took phi phi equals 0, because it's easy. And what he found is that if you track this data as it evolves, you could compute the mass of the black hole. I'll be a little specific about this in a minute. And found that the mass of the black hole depends on initial data parameters, which is proportional to a minus some critical value of a to some exponent.
Okay. So this is a strong data.
This is the strong data. So he found that, and I'm going to write that down. So this is what Matt Chopik calls supercritical for strong data. And there was subcritical, of course, there's no black hole formation, so there's no formula. And then there's critical, which was also investigated numerically. So in a supercritical case, found a mass formula for a black hole where A star and gamma are computed numerically. Okay. And A is just this parameter. Now, you can replace A by sigma. If you replace A by sigma, then this would be sigma minus sigma star for the same parameter gamma. And that was found numerically as well. So in the critical case, there's a naked singularity, as close to one as you can get. That's A equals A star. And in the subcritical case, he found that the scalar field scatters back. So in other words, in the last case, the scalar field comes in, sort of bounces around near R equals 0, and just disperses. In this case, it comes in, bounces a few times and forms a black hole. And in the naked singularity case, it was very interesting. It's a highly finely tuned naked singularity. And so it is actually a violation of the cosmic censorship hypothesis, because the cosmic censorship hypothesis says if you have asymptotically flat regular initial data, then its evolution can only lead to a black hole or dispersal, but it can't lead to a naked singularity. But this is sort of a highly finely tuned naked singularity, so people are sort of dismissing it as a counterexample because it isn't a large set of, it's not a large violation, it's just too finely tuned because A has to be exactly A star. But nevertheless, it is a violation of cosmic censorship, so you can argue about measure and so on, but it's a violation. Okay, so what did he actually compute to get the mass of the black hole? You cannot detect an event horizon numerically. Okay? You can only start from one slice, evolve, and get a big sandwich of space-time, but you can't detect an event horizon. So what is he detecting? What he's detecting is an apparent horizon. And so the apparent horizon detection runs like this. It's just another phase space function that you compute as you evolve. All right? So that phase space function is very easy. We've all heard about it. Here's the outward null expansion and the inward null expansion on that slice. So this is detecting So since we're in spherical symmetry, we have space foliated by spheres. You can focus on any one sphere, whichever one you like, and there's an outward and an inward non-geodesic direction.
Okay.
We'll call this LA plus, LA minus. So what's really done numerically is you check, see what spheres are trapped. So these are actually just space spheres, just a sphere in free space. So what you compute is the divergence sigma AB is the metric on the sphere. You compute this, this object is called theta plus. You compute the minus, it's called theta minus. So if the outward non-geodesic congruence, its expansion vanishes, then that's exactly the condition you get locally on, you get on the event horizon. Okay, except there's no event horizon here. It's just we're checking a sphere by sphere. So the test for a black hole, the test to see if a sphere is trapped is, yeah.
So the naked singularity in this case, actually, is the singular sphere in the.
So
this is in R, but we still have.
That's right. R equals zero. There's a naked singularity.
So inside the sphere, this is the single sphere. We have a black hole, and outside it.
No, there's no black hole because there's no horizon. As R reduces, you never check. You never get a trapping condition. You never get a horizon. And you go all the way to r equals 0, is seen. It's like negative mass logic. So think about this metric. It's exactly what, sort of this form. There's no analytical form for it. Okay. This has got no horizon. There's no real R value where this function vanishes. So, but R equals zero is a singularity. Okay. In fact, here R equals zero is a time-like singularity because if you have a horizon, R and T change roles at the horizon. So R equals constant outside the horizon, R equals constant is a time-like line. Inside the horizon, R equals constant is a space-like line. So R equals zero is space-like. Here, there's no such switch, but there's still a singularity. So something like this, it's not this, because we don't know it analytically. But that's what I mean by naked singularity.
So in this case, we just have a naked singularity. Which means the scalar field cannot be valid.
Scalar field is singular at R equals zero. Yeah, and so numerically what you see is just the scalar field blowing up.
But it's not the space-time itself, actually.
Well, it depends what you mean by space-time. Numerically, you can only get a sandwich of space-time. You can't get this global structure. Okay. So you follow the scalar field, you see there's a horizon forming. And that's the sort of test I was getting to. So either you see horizon detection or you don't. So there are cases where you see horizon detection up here. There are cases where you don't see horizon detection. The scalar field, you can follow it in and follow it back out. Reflects off R equals zero. In this case, you don't see the scalar field going out, back out from R equals zero back to R equals infinity. The scalar field sort of just piles up, and the curvature diverges, and the scalar field starts to diverge. That's sort of the numerical signal. And there's an analytical form of the metric. So what you compute, of course, is these functions. And so the test for a black hole, numerical test for a black hole, is very simple. You find a sphere or spheres
on which theta plus equals zero, theta minus less than zero. Okay? This is called marginal, this is would be called a marginally trapped sphere. Okay. Or marginal trapping condition. So full trapping, not marginal trapping, theta plus less than zero, theta minus less than zero. And normal space-time could appear. And normal sphere. Okay? In other words, if the sphere lights up, you expect an outgoing spherical wave and an ingoing spherical wave. Except if you pick up the sphere and put it in a strong gravitational field, it might become one of these, or it might be one of those. So what we do is, as we evolve in time, numerically, you follow not just f of r t equals 0 to the next time slice, to the next time slice, but you also compute this theta plus and theta minus. Function of r and t. So the initial data will have some function, theta plus r t equals 0, you just compute it from the initial data. And you know, it'll be something, theta plus is typically positive on good initial data. If you can, of course, construct the initial data such that theta plus has a 0 or more than one 0, this means that your initial data already has trapped surfaces. That's possible. And of course, we follow theta minus as well numerically. So we're just evolving these things, and to find out when a black hole first forms, you look at this graph on your particular time slice up to which you've evolved, and start scanning that function from the right hand, the large r end of your grid, all the way towards r equals 0, so you just spot a 0. You actually won't spot exactly 0 because you're doing numerical stuff. You'll spot something positive and then something negative on the next array element. Okay? So you know there's a 0. So in terms of phase space variables, of course, there's an exact formula for theta plus theta minus in terms of tr, r, d phi, phi. You just work it out, and that's what we did. So when we come to quantum theory, we sort of want to get the analog of things like this when, as we evolve some initial state. And that initial state has to be chosen in such a way that it represents something like a nice starting profile like this. Okay? But let me just come to that now. So essentially, these are the functions numerical relativists have always been using to see if there's a black hole or not. Now, how do they know that the apparent horizon, you know, the zero, is not going to move around and will keep evolving? Well, the idea is they want to get the result of a long time evolution. So they write codes that can evolve for a long, 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 long time. You want to make sure that that zero location where theta plus is zero stays sort of stable within some range. Then you can sort of argue that, you know, black hole is not going to get any bigger than this. Okay. Initially, of course, it will be zero. So really, the apparent horizon starts off really small, and then it slowly grows as more matter falls in. More matter falls in, the radius of the apparent horizon grows. So radius of the apparent horizon, I mean zeros of this function. Okay, so it could go like this, it could wind up back up like this. So if theta plus looks like this, it has an outer and an inner horizon, apparent horizon. Okay. So as we evolve in time, we're sort of following the time trajectory of the zeros. Okay. I mean, I don't have an extra dimension here, but you know. In the case of the scalar field, what we find is typically there's just one. We want to find the outermost one and use that as a measure for the size of the black hole. So this MBH, really, the bottom line is this is really the zero of that theta plus. Right? That's what's taken to be the mass of the black hole. OK, so that's the end of this. Now you can sort of modify the Einstein equation, add a cosmological constant, do other things. You find pretty much this kind of behavior. So
if you go to a different kind of matter, this changes. Initially, people thought this is universal too, independent of matter, but it isn't. Okay. It's independent of the shape, but not the matter. Okay.
In your minimal coupling, to the scalar field by mastering.
So you mean if you go to non-minimal coupling, what happens?
I can't remember how you showed the minimal coupling. Did you include a mass term?
No, no, no. There's no mass term. There's zero mass. Yeah, you can do all of this with a mass term.
Right.
So actually, I'll just take a little break here before starting to talk with you.
Yes. So question about the action that you raised on this board.
Yeah.
So you wrote it down in terms of the R and PR.
That's right. And phi and P5, yeah.
Now, so then on that side, you said that phi plus and minus is a function of those. Can you invert
the theta plus theta minus is a function of those?
Yeah.
Yes.
Can you invert the action and write it in terms of the phi plus and phi minus? And then what would the NRCR term look in terms of phi plus?
You mean in terms of these thetas?
Yeah.
No, it's probably not invertible because these are just two variables and these are four phase space variables. These are just two functions of phase space, so it's definitely not invertible.
So, is there an easy way to see in this NRCR term what gives a black hole and what doesn't?
No, there's no easy way. The NRCR term, the CR term is just a Diffeo generator, which is a specific function of the phase space variables. This is a different function of the phase space variables. In fact, as we evolve, if we want to do a physical evolution, we have to ensure the CR remains zero, because it's a constraint, or expectation value CR remains zero, or CR equals zero is held strongly as a operator condition. Right, so one is a constraint, and these are just what we might call useful observables or interesting observables that we want to keep track of when we go to the funding theory. Any other questions? Right. You get a drink of water or something.